From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Jane Twenge says there's a difference between communicating with someone by texting them and just by talking with them. And I know that sounds obvious, but Twenge, who is a professor of psychology and a writer, often hears the argument that there's no real reason to worry about the effect of smartphones on teenagers. But in her new book, she points out interacting with someone in person is linked to good mental health, whereas electronic communication is linked to poor mental health. And this current generation of young people, she says, is at the forefront of the worst mental health crisis in decades. Today in the program, Twenge is joining us to talk about this generation. She calls it iGen. And she says the complete domination of the smartphone for iGeners is having a ripple effect on every aspect of their lives. Join us after the news.
Support for this Radio West podcast comes from Primary Children's Hospital. They're one of 24 children's hospitals in the country that's been recognized by U.S. News and World Reports for providing excellent care in all 10 pediatric specialties. Primary Children's Hospital, the child first and always.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For nearly 25 years now, Jane Twenge has been studying and researching the differences in generations, like how the Gen Xers are different from the baby boomers, or how millennials are different from the Gen Xers. In fact, she wrote a book about millennials called Generation Me. Twenge says year after year she would see these differences in generations reflected in line graphs. And mostly they were gradual changes that looked like gently rolling hills on the graph paper. But she says right around 2012, she started seeing really steep peaks appear, rapid drop-offs and sheer cliffs. She says she had never seen anything like it. And it took a while to figure it out, but then it occurred to her. Right around 2012 was when the majority of Americans started owning smartphones. The smartphone was changing the culture and changing it fast. And at the center of this change is the generation born in 1995 and later. This is the group that doesn't know a world without internet access or smartphones. Twenge calls this generation iGen. And in a new book, she explains what effect the complete dominance of the smartphone is having on iGeners' lives. Today in the program, Jane Twenge is joining us to talk about what she's learned. Her book is iGen. Now get ready for the subtitle, Why Today's Super-Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. And she's joining us today from a studio in San Diego. And Jane Twenge, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I guess I wanted to start with that. I don't know if it was an epiphany you had about something changing in 2012, but let's talk about what you when it occurred to you and when you put two and two together that this was maybe about the smartphone in this generation.
It was a slow process because first I started seeing these big increases in symptoms of depression. And just for context, these are from very large national surveys of teens that are done every year. It's about a million people at this point, 8th graders, 10th graders, and 12th graders who fill out these surveys. And there were these big spikes in depressive symptoms and also in loneliness and eventually in happiness and life satisfaction too. So that made me start to think about why that might have occurred, especially because the Great Recession was over at that point, or at least getting better.
Yeah.
Unemployment peaked around 2010 and then got better from there. So that period from 2012 to early 2016, the economy was getting better. There were no big political upheavals. This was pre-Trump. There were no big events that really had a big effect on teens' lives. But then I realized 2012, according to a Pew Center survey, was exactly the year when the percentage of Americans with a smartphone crossed 50%. And for teens, that's huge. That's by far the largest change to their lives over that time period.
You say in the book that we all need to come to understand this generational shift. Why is that important for us to understand that?
Well, overall, I just think it's really, really important to keep tabs on what teens and young adults are telling us about how they're feeling, how they're living their lives, so we can really gain an understanding for how that experience is different from the millennials when they were teens, just 10 years ago for some of them, and for my own generation, Generation X, for when we were teenagers. So to understand our children, to understand our coworkers, for me as a faculty member to understand my students, it's essential to really listen to teens and young adults today and see how they're different.
I guess we should explain first, and I mentioned this in the introduction, what you mean by iGen. This is the group that was born in 1995 and later. And the crucial point here, of course, is that they grew up with smartphones. So in that sense, technology is pretty much all they know. As someone said that you talked to, the internet is a fact of nature for them. It's baked into them. It's just intuitive to them, I guess.
Yeah, 1995 was the year the internet was commercialized.
Yeah.
So a lot of this data coalesced around folks who were 16 or 17 in 2012. So that points to the mid-90s as well, as does that cutoff. But if you think about the life of someone who was born in the mid-90s to later, to them, a telephone has never been big and heavy. They don't know, I've never used a fax machine. Record players are foreign to them. I tried this recently at a book signing. I showed some kids a picture of a Rolodex, and of course none of them knew what it was, and every older person in the room did.
Yeah. So I think I know the answer to this, but just how much market saturation are we talking about with a generation in terms of smartphones? Pretty much all of them, most of them, right?
Yeah. So, you know, those figures are a little bit hard to come by, but it's around 90% of teens today who have a smartphone, and 2/3 of them specifically have an iPhone.
The average teen checks her phone, you say in the book, for more than 80 times a day. And I guess this right away gets us to one of the trends that you identify in the book, and we'll go through these as we go throughout the show. And this is one of the trends shaping the lives of iGeners, and it's the internet, of course. And so I wanted to ask about that because I guess the big question, and you ask, how much time are they spending on their phones and what has that replaced? Talk about that.
Yeah. So, you know, that was actually one of the first things I noticed in these big surveys. I was looking at, you know, kind of across the board, all the questions about how teens spend their time. And I started to see these trends that had started with the millennials, but then really started to accelerate after 2010, away from spending time with their friends. Just every single question, if it had to do with spending time with your friends in person, hanging out with them informally, going out without your parents, going to the mall, going to the movies, driving around in a car, all of those were in kind of a downward trajectory and then fell off a cliff after 2010. So if you really look at how teens spend their time, the amount of time they spend on paid jobs has actually gone down. Mm-hmm. The amount of time they spend on homework is either unchanged or down. The amount of time they spend on extracurricular activities is about the same. But what's really shifted is their time interacting with their friends in person has really plummeted, and the time that they spend on electronic communication has skyrocketed. That's the biggest change in their leisure time.
So explain how you went about exploring this generation, because one of the things you point out early in the book is you can't really just rely on one-time polls. I mean, they don't really tell you anything about cultural change. And you write this in the book. You said to really understand what's unique about this generation, and it is unique, as you say, we need to compare iGen to previous generations when their members were young. So talk about these databases that you use to really figure this stuff out.
Yeah, so there's four of them. One is the one I mentioned earlier of 8th, 10th, and 12th graders called Monitoring the Future. It's been done since 1976 for the 12th graders, since 1991 for the 8th and 10th graders, done every year. There's a survey called American Freshmen that's been done of entering college students since 1966. There's the Centers for Disease Control runs this survey called the Youth Risk Behavior Surveillance System, and it's been done since 1991. And then there's the General Social Survey, which is people 18 and up. That's been going on since 1972. So these are really wonderful databases because they're nationally representative, so people from every background are included. They do a really good job of making sure of that. Right. And they go back in time. They're a time machine. You can see what boomers looked like when in the General Social Survey. You can see what boomers looked like when they were in their 20s, when they were 18 or 19. And the same for, you know, these other surveys, and follow boomers, Gen Xers, millennials, and iGen, and compare them at the same age. So you know that you're seeing cultural change or generational differences, and you're not looking at the effects of, say, just being young, yeah, which is the problem you get with a one-time survey.
Well, that's what you hear all the time, it seems like. You're probably having to answer this question or this critique that, look, young people have always been this way. They're rebellious, or they're this, or they're that. I mean, one of the points of your book is that they're, this iGen group is significantly distinct, right?
They really are. So for the longest time in doing work on generations, I found that the transitions between them were fairly slow. So there weren't sudden changes. Like it's you don't see a sudden change between people born in the late 70s, who are usually considered Gen Xers, and those born in the early 80s, who are considered millennials. There are differences, obviously, you know, based on when you were born and generational differences that build over time. But there were very few sudden breaks from one generation to the next. This was one of the first times that I had seen such a sudden break, generationally speaking, between, in this case, millennials and iGen. Now, that sudden break didn't show up for every behavior or every indicator, but it showed up for more than in past generations.
So you have this quiz early in the book that you ask people to take to give a sense of, you know, for example, how my Gen X experience overlaps with iGen. I mean, I wanted to go through a few of these and talk about the questions, what you're trying to learn, and where there might be overlap. So, like, number one in the quiz: in the past 24 hours, did you spend at least an hour total texting on a cell phone? Is my generation different from iGen in that one?
Well, we don't have great data on that.
Really?
The data that I'm looking at is on young people.
Right.
So the broader question that you can ask, which is a great question, is this idea of spending an enormous amount of time on electronic communication at the expense of FaceTime with others, is that occurring for adults too?
Right.
I'd like to look at that in future research, because my guess is the answer is yes. It may not be at the same level that it is for teens, but I suspect that the same thing has happened for adults too.
Here's a question. Do you consider yourself a religious person? That's one of the important distinctions. iGen is decidedly less interested in what, I guess, organized religion, or I guess what are the attitudes?
Yeah. So this, and so in religion, this is something where there is a pronounced generation gap comparing iGen teens to millennials when they were teens, Gen Xers, boomers when they were teens. And there's a pronounced generation gap right now between teens and young adults and those who are older. So these trends started with Gen X, and then especially the millennials, as you mentioned, away from organized religion, away from affiliating with a religion or going to religious services or having trust in religious institutions. But with late millennials and especially iGen, the shift is not just in organized religion, but also in private religious beliefs. So belief in God or prayer, two things that are not necessary, don't have to be associated with a religious organization. So IGEN is much less likely to say that they pray or to say that they believe in God. About one out of four now say they never pray and that they don't believe in God, which is a quite pronounced difference compared to the other generations.
Why? Like, how do you explain? Mm-hmm. I mean, I have to say, every time I looked at these trends and these different attitudes, we'll get to sex and we'll get to politics too. But at the end, when you say that they have decidedly different ideas about any of these things, I have to say, well, why would that be?
Right.
Based on a device that they have access to that has technology.
It's not all smartphones.
Yeah.
So a lot of these trends we're talking about, like with mental health and so on, I think the signs point, given that there was this sudden break and the other data we'll talk about, I think the signs point toward smartphones potentially being the primary cause for some of those trends. But many of these other trends, it's not just the smartphone. It's many, many other cultural changes. So with religion, for example, it's the growth of cultural individualism that is probably at the core of that shift. More focus on the self, less focus on social rules. This has been going on for a while, and it just keeps going, that religion is about something bigger than yourself. It tends to be about being with other people. Mm-hmm. And our culture has moved away from that in the past few decades.
You say that this individualism, and I'll quote you here in the book, for iGeners, is a trend that grounds their bedrock sense of equality as well as their rejection of traditional social rules. Explain what you mean. Their sense of individualism is distinct and important here, and it grounds their sense of equality. Mm-hmm. And that's another really important distinction here. Their sense of equality is really important. We'll talk about that part, the individualism and their sense of equality.
So individualism, like any cultural system, has upsides and downsides. And what many people consider the biggest upside is that when you treat people as individuals, you tend to set aside their membership in a group, whether that's gender or race or sexual orientation or anything else. You treat people as individuals. So iGen has this bedrock sense that people should be who they are and should explore their own ideas and passions, rather than being restricted by traditional roles based on race or gender, or the idea that you should, say, change your sexual orientation. So for them, particularly around sexual orientation and LGBT issues, they have just grown up with lots of cultural acceptance of gays and lesbians, and they just take it more or less for granted in a way that previous generations don't. They may have come to those beliefs later on, and many of them have, but for iGen, it was there from the beginning.
And it's fair to say that is that's a positive aspect of this generation, which gets us to a point you make in the book, that not all generational changes have to be seen as negative, and that, as you say, this isn't a contest to see which generation is the worst. Because, you know, you hear baby boomers, people say baby boomers ruined everything, or millennials are self-absorbed. But it seems like what you're trying to do with the book is in some ways kind of put that idea aside.
I would love to put that idea aside. You know, when I first started doing work on generations, you know, particularly my book Generation Me on the millennials, I was honestly shocked by how many people would frame things in terms of whose fault something was.
Yeah.
'Cause that's just not how I think about things at all. Or recently with the iGen book, there have been some commentators who have seemed to think that if there are these negative trends in mental health, well, then I and everybody else must think everything is bad. And of course, that's not the case. There's so many positive trends as well. So equality is one. There's many other trends with iGen that many people would consider good. For example, they drink less alcohol. They're less likely to have sex as high school students. The teen pregnancy rate is down. And in my view, seeing things as good or bad completely misses the big picture of what's really going on. Let's look at everything, good, bad, neutral, whatever. And then the idea of fault or blaming is also counterproductive in my view, because we're all in this together. Mm-hmm. These are cultural changes. That's what creates generational differences in the first place. So finger pointing is not really going to get us anywhere. Let's listen. Let's understand.
And it's such a mixed bag. One thing feeds off the other. And it's like, for example, you mentioned that they're less inclined to have sex early on, which is, I think, if you're trying to avoid, you know, all of the attendant problems to, you know, sexual activity early on in life, that's a good thing. But it's also that plays into the question that they're more isolated physically based on these devices.
That very well could be. So, yeah, that trend in teen sex had started with the millennials before the smartphone, but then, like many others, it accelerated. So now we have a generation who is often exposed to pornography online at a very early age, mm-hmm. In which middle schools have a problem with nudes that kids will send, you know, nude pictures of themselves, and then those spread like wildfire around middle schools, yet is waiting longer to physically have sex. So more sexting and less actual sex, just like there's less hanging out in person and more electronic communication.
Jean Twenge is with us. Her book is iGen, Why Today's Super Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. We'll take a break and come back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with Jean Twenge, who is a professor of psychology at San Diego State University, and for years now has been studying generational differences. She's been looking lately at this generation born after 1995. It's the young people who didn't know a time when there wasn't an internet or a smartphone. Twenge calls it iGen, and she says their attitudes about religion and sex and politics are really, really different. They socialize in different ways. They don't want to grow up. They're obsessed with safety, and they're often lonely and depressed. Her new book is iGen, Why Today's Super Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood, and What That Means for the Rest of Us. She's joining us from a studio in San Diego. So let's talk about another one of these trends you've been able to identify with iGen, and that is the trend of being insecure. And this gets us at something you say, that this iGen, they're at the forefront of a mental health crisis. Talk about that part, because there's so much fear and there's so much anxiety, it seems, in iGen.
Yeah, so these mental health trends are really troubling, and they're especially troubling because they appear across so many different symptoms and behaviors and data sources. So I found in my analyses of the Monitoring the Future data that there was an uptick, quite pronounced uptick, in symptoms of depression after 2012, also of loneliness, and the happiness started to fall, as did life satisfaction. But even more concerning are some other sources. So there's a national screening study that's been done every year looking at teens, 12 to 17-year-olds, found a 50% increase in the percentage who fit the criteria for clinical-level depression. The suicide rate for young teens, 12 to 14-year-olds, has doubled for boys and tripled for girls.
Wow.
There's a 50% increase in the suicide rate for older teens, 15 and 19-year-olds. Some college surveys of entering college students say show the same thing, rising rates of anxiety and feeling overwhelmed and feeling depressed. There's a study of kids and teens being hospitalized for suicidal thoughts and self-harm. That's doubled in 10 years. So there's so many signs of iGen really struggling with mental health in a way I think we really need to pay attention to.
You say young people are more likely than young people today are more likely than young people 5 or 10 years ago to say they're anxious.
Mm-hmm.
What do they mean by that? What are they anxious about? Can you tell?
Well, a lot of the data is around depression, and depression and anxiety are very, very closely related. So the anxiety questions, one of them is about feeling overwhelming anxiety, and the other says it's about feeling overwhelmed by all you have to do. And then that can often, the way this works, the trajectory is that anxiety then can crash into depression. And that seems to be what we're seeing. And so trying to find out exactly why this is happening is challenging. So my best guess, based on all of the data, that when teens and young adults are spending so much less time interacting with friends and family in person, that face-to-face interaction that's the basis for mental health, that creates a vulnerability, a fragility, which is then broken or exacerbated by spending so much time on a screen where you're waiting for somebody to respond to your text, where you're not sure if you're going to get those likes on your Facebook or Instagram post that you wanted, where there's this, you know, anonymous, often vicious feedback from others. And even when it's positive, maybe it took too long or maybe it wasn't enough.
Mm-hmm.
There's just so much anxiety right there in your hand and you can't get away from it because that phone for most teens is in their hands all the time, day and night.
Right. Has the science made a causal link yet between, say, loneliness and smartphones? Or are we just sort of relying on a connection and some hunches at this point till we can really nail it down?
Yeah. So the analyses I was able to do are correlational. So they can't prove causation. But there's so that leaves always the possibility, for example, that unhappy people are more likely to, say, use social media. But there are three other studies, high quality studies by other researchers, that more or less rule out that explanation. Mm-hmm. There are two that follow people over time and found that social media use led to unhappiness, but unhappiness didn't lead to social media use or loneliness. And then there's another that flip of the coin, true experiment. Half the people gave up Facebook for a week and the other half did not. And those who gave up Facebook ended the week happier, less lonely, and less depressed than those who kept up their normal use. So that one actually does show causation. It is still early days with these things. Obviously, we do need more studies. But those three point fairly definitively in the direction that social media does seem to lead to unhappiness, lower psychological well-being.
So this was interesting. About what you've learned. We sometimes talk about how kids grow up so fast these days, you know, gosh. But quite the opposite seems to be true with mm-hmm. iGen. You say iGeners are growing up more slowly.
They are. So in these big surveys of teens, this was something else that I started to notice when I looked at how they spent their time. So let's take high school seniors, 12th graders, 17, 18 years old, spring of their senior year. They're asked if they have a driver's license, for example, how often they go out without their parents, whether they have a job, all these things that are things adults do that children don't,
right. That
adolescence is the time when you do those things for the first time. So 12th graders, iGen, 12th graders now, much less likely than millennials, Gen Xers, and boomers at the same age to have a driver's license, to drive at all, to have a paid job, to drink alcohol, to have sex, to go on dates, to go out without their parents. So all these indicators of adulthood, both the responsibilities and the pleasures of adulthood, are now less common. And similar trends showed up for 10th graders and 8th graders as well. So alcohol is a really interesting example of this.
Yeah.
Among young adults, so 21, 22 years, almost all of them have tried alcohol and drink, you know, in the last 30 days or a year. But a lot less fewer eighth graders do that now. And so that decline in alcohol use is the biggest for the 8th graders, mm-hmm. a little bit less for 10th, a little bit less for 12th, and it just tapers off. So they're eventually going to drink alcohol. They're yeah. just doing it later.
Well, here's one of the chapter headings which asks a question. Is this because teens are more responsible?
Mm-hmm. Right. So that's – I have seen many articles over the past few years commenting on one or another of these trends. So one, for example, noted that teens were less likely to get pregnant now, less likely to have sex, less likely to drink alcohol, and said, oh, they're more virtuous.
Right.
Than previous generations. They must be more responsible. They yeah. must have more self-control. But that analysis didn't mention that they're also less likely to drive, that they're also less likely to work. Is that more or less virtuous or responsible? It's not really neither one. It doesn't fit in that pattern. Same thing for some of the articles about teen pregnancy. There's been a lot of speculation about why the teen pregnancy rate is low. Maybe smartphones have something to do with it. That's possible. But there's lots of other theories being bandied around. But I think in isolation, those trend pieces miss the big picture, which is it's not that they're more virtuous. It's not that they're more responsible. It's not that they're lazy. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why that's what some people say about why they're not working. It's none of those. It's that they're taking longer yeah. to grow up.
This gets us to another trend you call indefinite, which is about their attitudes about sex and relationships and children. Does iGen talk about wanting to have kids, putting off having kids? Are they too young for us to really discern that at this point?
So that high school senior survey asks about having kids and getting married, and those attitudes are really stable across the generation. So iGen is almost as likely to say they expect to get married and have kids someday. But what was striking to me in looking at their attitudes was that they place less importance on marriage and family even then millennials did just 10 years ago at the same age, that they just don't rate it as important as these previous generations did.
Another one of these trends that gets at, I think, political attitudes is two that I wanted to ask you about. One is inclusive and one is independent. We've kind of talked about this a bit, but their sense of acceptance, their sense of equality – you've kind of talked about, but I wondered, do you think you're learning something about iGeners in terms of their sense of free speech when you look at these free speech debates raging on some college campuses now in the country? What do we know about iGeners and their sense of free speech and trigger warnings and all this kind of ultra sensitivity that we seem to be seeing in this younger generation?
Yeah, so that American Freshman Survey of entering college students has asked some questions about this, which really is a great way to see how today's college students differ from those in the past. So we can know that this is really truly a generational thing and not just something college students have always done. So yes, iGen college students are more likely to say that campuses should place restrictions on racist or sexist speech. They are also more likely to say that campuses should ban controversial speakers from campus. And sure enough, this trend toward, quote, disinviting speakers, so speakers who have been invited and then the students say, no, we don't want this person to come, has just skyrocketed since 2000. It used to be virtually unheard of. And then in 2016, there were 42 disinvitations across the country. So these free speech debates have really roiled college campuses in the last 5 years, just as iGen started to get to college. And I think what's been missing in that discussion is why this generation is so concerned with speech. And I think there's a number of reasons. One of them is the smartphone and is electronic communication, that if your primary way of communicating with people is online and through texting and social media, your focus is on words. Mm-hmm. Your focus is not as much on physical altercations as it is written and verbal ones. And I think this is one of the reasons at the extremes we get the idea with some iGeners of words as violence, because that's where that attitude ends up.
There's another trend that you identify, which you call insulated but not intrinsic. And it gets at this obsession we have, they have, this generation has with safety. Mm-hmm. And one aspect of that is that they're, as you say in the book, they're basically checking out of civic involvement.
Right. So let's take the part about safety first.
Yeah.
So iGen is most likely the safest generation in American history, physically speaking.
Yeah.
They have higher life expectancy. They're less likely to die in car accidents. They're less likely to die in homicides. The only place where their safety has really grown worse is in suicide. So they are very, very interested in safety and not as interested in taking risks as previous generations were. 8th and 10th graders are less likely to say that they get a kick out of doing dangerous things or think it's fun to do things that are risky. Mm. And that is a very pervasive trend that if you start to listen for the word safety, you'll hear it a lot, especially in education and the explanation for why a certain rule was put in place. And that's, of course, the parents are very much participants in mm-hmm. that trend. So with iGen, for them, safety isn't just about physical safety. It's also about something they call emotional safety. So that was a phrase I wasn't familiar with before I started doing the interviews for this book. But some teens told me that emotional safety was just as important or even more important than physical safety. Mm-hmm. And many of them said it was even more frightening because, as one of them put it, you can always take precautions to be physically safe, but as he said, quote, you can't help but listen when someone is talking to you.
Wow. So that explains why they're not engaging in these civic conversations. They're insulating themselves, I suppose.
That could be part of it. I don't necessarily see those two trends as completely related to each other. There's also individualism also plays a big role in that.
Yeah.
With the idea of people should fend for themselves rather than, you know, banding together to help. So iGen is an interesting picture when it comes to civic engagement. On the one hand, they're more likely than young adults about 10 years ago to say that helping people is important. Their empathy is higher in some aspects, not in others. But they have a harder time taking action. So they're actually less likely to say donate to charity or to say that the problems of others are their business. So there's a gap between thought and action there.
Let's talk about how parenting is playing a role, because you write in the book, parents are, you know, they're worried about the physical stuff, you know, their kids going out and partying. And so they probably like hearing that young people, iGeners, are drinking at an older age. They're putting that off. Mm-hmm. But you say often parents aren't worrying about their kid who decides to just stay home with their phone. Would you talk about that?
Yeah. So I think that's a very common thing. And I have three kids, so I understand these worries when they're out of the house, and especially once they become teenagers and they're driving around and who knows what they're doing with their friends. But when they stay home, it's not like they're having wholesome family dinners with you and talking to you face to face for hours.
Right, right.
Maybe some of them are, but that's not the norm. The norm is they're in their room, usually with a tablet or on their phone, either communicating with their friends or watching Netflix or surfing the web or playing a game. And I think they're maybe because it just physically might be safer. A lot of parents have, you know, kind of breathed a sigh of relief that their kid's at home and in their room instead of out with their friends. And that may be physically safer, but more than likely it's not as good for their mental health to be on that screen instead of hanging out with their friends in person. And there's a very, very clear correlation I found. This was one of those graphs that really kind of blew me away, was looking at the correlation between happiness and how teens spend their time. Every single activity you could do on a screen was connected to less happiness. Every single activity you could do not on a screen was connected to more happiness. So that's things like spending time with friends in person, exercise, religious services, reading, books or magazines, even homework, surprisingly, didn't make kids unhappy, but or at least wasn't correlated with unhappiness. But TV, social media, internet time, gaming, all of it correlated with less happiness.
Jean Twenge is with us. Her book is iGen, Why Today's Super-Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood, and What That Means for the Rest of Us. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Support for this Radio West podcast comes from Salt Lake County Animal Services, a no-kill municipal shelter specializing in pet adoptions, licensing, humane education, and more. Located at 511 West, 3900 South in Salt Lake City. More information is at AdoptUtahPets.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Jean Twenge. We're talking about her book, iGen. She's joining us from a studio in San Diego. Well, so let's talk about some of the things that you mention in the book that you think we can do to make things better, as you say, for iGeners. First of all, say something about this balance you think we need to strike between, as you say, solutions on one hand and acceptance on the other. It seems like there's this trade-off you're looking for in some way.
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously, you know, we live in this connected world where almost everybody has a smartphone. So I think the key here is moderation. And that's partially based on the research data, that if you look at these correlations between screen time and unhappiness or mental health issues, including suicide risk, the effects don't show up until you're looking at, say, on any one activity, let's say social media, 2 hours a day or more of use. Same thing for spending time online. For gaming and so on. So the key is not to yank the smartphone out of your teen's hands. Mm-hmm. It's not going to go well anyway.
Right.
Instead, it's to put limits. So there are apps that you can put on your teen's phone to limit the amount of time he or she spends on certain activities. There's also the idea of moderation in terms of when kids get smartphones. Mm-hmm. So the average age for kids now to get a smartphone is 10. Yet they're really not able to handle a lot of social media and texting, a lot of the things that go on in that age group until they're a little older. And sure enough, that, for example, that correlation between social media and unhappiness is much larger for eighth graders than it is for 12th graders, for example.
Yeah.
So that points toward waiting to get that smartphone until kids are older. And you know, if they want to connect a little on social media, they can get an account on your desktop and do it in a very limited way. But wait, you know, some time before they have that constant stimulation right there in their hands all the time.
I like how you point out, and I've heard this before, that look, if Steve Jobs could limit the use of technology for his kids, you can too.
Yep. Exactly. He did. So a reporter was interviewing him right around the time the iPad came out in 2010, and he said, oh, your kids must love this. And he said, no, we limit the amount of technology they're exposed to at home. Melinda Gates recently wrote a piece in the Washington Post talking about finding balance with her kids around this technology. So there are many others in Silicon Valley and the tech world who realize that for their children, that having the exposure to these devices at a very early age in an unlimited way is probably not the best idea.
Yeah. What do you do about porn and the exposure for young people? You say parents need to prevent children and teens from seeing pornography, which seems obvious, but it also seems so. Is that even possible?
It is difficult,
yeah.
That's for sure. But you know, there are programs that can, restrict that. you know, some of it is just not handing them the iPad and, you know, not looking to see what they're doing.
Exactly.
I think that's a common thing. You hand them the parents' iPad. So my oldest is 10, and so, you know, we run into this, and because she wants to read books on her school district's library, she can read books on the iPad. But we had a talk about how she's going to read the book on the iPad, and she's not going to go around and surf the web. And then, you know, thankfully she hasn't, but there have been a couple times where I catch her playing a game instead of reading the book, and then she loses the iPad for a day or two. So I think it's these limits have to be there in place. And with pornography, it's just you just have to keep in mind that that's out there, and to try to do whatever you can to make sure that especially these younger kids aren't seeing it. And even with older teens, you know, this is a bigger family discussion, but people who have looked at changes in sexual behavior among college students over the last 10 years have come to the conclusion that porn has had a very negative effect on sex in college, that it's increasingly emotionally cold, that students increasingly talk about hooking up without having any feelings involved. And many people are convinced that that's because of their exposure to pornography.
There's another thing you write about how online time does not protect against loneliness and depression. Well, in-person time does. Mm-hmm. And this is something I really liked this. You said, given the benefits of in-person social interaction, parents need to stop thinking that their kids who are hanging out together is a waste of time, that they should start looking at that as like, this is a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you know, you think about how we want our kids to succeed in the world. And so we make sure they do their homework and get them involved in extracurricular activities and so on. But one of the skills that they're going to need is social skills. And they're not developing those social skills when they're communicating electronically. Plus, it's not great for their mental health for their communication to primarily be through a screen. So when they're hanging out with their friends, it's filling up their reserve of mental health, and they're learning something from it too that'll be very useful for them in the future.
You in the book you talk about the things that you did to study this generational difference. You interviewed iGeners in person, of course. You posed these written interview questions, and you read a lot of essays and a lot of opinion pieces. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you said is that these kids are deeply aware of the negative effects of smartphones, which leads me to this sense of hopefulness. I mean, if they have a sense of self-awareness about all of this, that's got to be a good thing, right?
I definitely think it's a good thing. That was certainly something that gave me hope, because I went into these interviews knowing the survey data, knowing that they're spending 6 to 8 hours a day on screens, that they have never known a world without smartphones. So I was pleasantly surprised that, for example, in these 200 college freshmen and sophomores who filled out these open-ended questions for me, all of them said they would rather see their friends in person than communicate electronically. And then in the interviews, so many of them said those same things. You know, you can see somebody's face, you can give them a hug, it's so much more fulfilling. Yet they don't. They don't do that as much. And they have their own reasons for it, but none of them really hold up in terms of the behavior of the average teen or young adult and why this has changed. What I ended up realizing is it's because it's addictive and because it's convenient and because it's easy, that the way that they talked about that electronic communication is they often felt like they had to. They didn't really want to, but they had to, which is the way that addicts talk about things.
Yeah. But you say if they can just find a way to shake themselves free from their phones, they can succeed. Do you think they can do it?
I hope so, because there's so much potential with this generation. I mean, as just one example, their work ethic is considerably stronger than teens just 10 years ago. So they're more willing to, you know, to work hard at something. They experienced the Great Recession as children. They see this very competitive job market, and they want to make it.
Yeah.
Very, very much so. And their sensitivity is a real strength. Their belief in equality is such a strength. So if they don't need to throw those smartphones away, but if they can use them as a tool, instead of smartphones being a tool that uses them, I can see iGen being very successful.
When does iGen end as a discrete generation? Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense?
So in the book, I had to settle on a date.
Yeah.
So we started in 95. That seems reasonably clear. But when does it end? So I settled on 2012 because that's about the same length that millennials were. But we don't know.
We don't know.
It's all about the data and all about how those kids look when they get old enough to fill out those surveys in 8th grade and 10th grade. So my youngest child was born in 2012. She started kindergarten this year. And I think it definitely remains to be seen if she's going to be the same generation as her sisters and as today's teens and youngest adults.
Well, I mean, if we're worried about the effect of an iPhone on iGeners, I mean, what effect will devices with really sophisticated artificial intelligence in the future have? I guess it's just speculation at that point, but there's always going to be a challenge. Technology is offering, I guess, more and more questions.
Yeah, and I think there's also a question, too, of, you know, these youngest iGeners and those, you know, who are going to be in this other generation after them, about even the technology we have right now and how it's affected them, of how is it going to affect verbal development that we have so many toddlers and even babies in strollers with the screen right in front of them. There are strollers that even have it built in. And then how all of this future technology in terms of, you know, robots in particular, there's already many people speculating about how, you know, we talk to Siri and that feels like a real person, but of course it's not. And what effect is that going to have on all of us?
It's Jean Twenge. Her book is iGen, Why Today's Super Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood, and What That Means for the Rest of Us. She joined us from a studio in San Diego. Professor, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you. Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.